The letter of Clement of Rome, written somewhere between 90 and 100 AD, is a very precious example of the early church struggling to discover its identity in the Roman world, and also an example of the shifts and changes that are taking place with the passing of the apostolic age and the development of new forms of leadership in the church. We see in Clement, who is traditionally regarded as the third occupant of the See of Rome after St. Peter, an example of someone who is certainly aware of the importance in the minds of his people of the example of the martyrs. And in fact, this letter is not written to the church in Rome, but actually to the church in Corinth, where something has happened which has agitated churches elsewhere, and particularly concerned the Bishop of Rome, Clement. And that is that the Corinthians, the members of that church, have ejected their own church leaders. They've decided to depose and get rid of those who were appointed to be an authority over them. And if we look at other documents from this period and a little before, the Didache, for example, we see that from the apostolic period, the passing of the apostles left behind a series of ministries within the church. Teachers, people who were primarily gifted with what were thought to be charismatic gifts, prophets, ecstatics, people who spoke in tongues, and wandering ministers, wandering preachers as well, itinerant folk who would show up and describe themselves as having a word from another church. But Clement is a witness to the fact that there is also a tradition which is becoming the most prominent, the most significant one, that the apostles, following the example of Christ and following God's own intention, themselves designated their successors by the laying on of hands. And so Clement is the first to articulate a doctrine of apostolic succession. And he's concerned to emphasize this to the church at Corinth so that they understand that it isn't just up to them to decide who's going to be in leadership over them, and that they don't have the right to simply eject church leadership once it has been established through a ministry that comes from the apostles and actually represents a connection between the rest of the churches. So the question of spiritual leadership, spiritual guidance, in the mind of Clement is that it comes from Christ, it is transmitted by Christ in this charism of succession to the apostles and then to those whom the apostles have designated. There's one thing about this particular letter one has to bear in mind so as not to be confused, and that is that there is no clear distinction between what we would today call the term presbyter, which is often translated as priest, but actually literally means elder. There's no distinction in Clement's letter between presbyter and bishop, episkopos. So the terms are used relatively interchangeably, and clearly he's using it in reference to his own office and the office that is used elsewhere. We'll see that in the letter of Ignatius, there's a very clear distinction. Presbyters are distinct from the bishop, and that group is distinct from the deacons, who assist in a variety of ways. In Clement's letter at this time in the Church of Rome, the clear use of that terminology to designate different groups was not as specific as it was elsewhere. So when we see him using the term presbyter or elder, he's also referring to the same office that he describes as bishop. And spiritual guidance, spiritual leadership is for him now something that focuses on the episcopal ministry, on the person who has responsibility for the local church. And as we'll see, that person becomes a kind of organ of unity, an organ of harmony. There are a variety of themes in the selections from this letter which are before you, but we'll only be able to highlight a few of them. And let's note first, beginning in chapter 5, that he, Clement, uses the example of the martyrs, not so much to emphasize the martyrs' role in spiritual guidance or leadership, that it is the martyrs to whom one turns, but rather because there have been martyrs, and the memory in the Church of Rome is particularly vivid because of the Neronian persecutions that took place, that which was really the first persecution of the Christian Church in 64 AD, and he calls attention, and again, remember, he's not primarily writing for the Church in Rome, but to the church in Corinth, which knows the example of the Roman Christians and reveres it very strongly. Clement uses the example of the martyrdom of Peter and Paul, not primarily to talk about their ministry as martyrs, but instead to point out that by rejecting church leadership, the Corinthians are putting themselves in a position rather analogous to those who persecuted the church. So he wants to shame the Corinthians using the example of martyrdom. And this is a very different use of the model of the martyr as spiritual guide or spiritual leader than the one that we see later in the writings of Perpetua and Felicity, or even in the example of the martyr Bishop Polycarp. Let's look at chapter 5, the first selection. Through envy and jealousy, the greatest and most righteous pillars of the church were persecuted and put to death. Zelos and Thonos, these terrible things. Zelos in the sense of an envy, of a zeal that is destructive and ultimately destroys, results in a kind of a hatred. That is what was underlying the persecutions that are still fresh in people's minds and which particularly pertain to the church in Rome, and which authority Clement is claiming. He reminds them of the example of Peter and Paul. If you drop down below the picture and the commentary from Tacitus, let us set before our eyes the illustrious apostles. Peter, through unrighteous envy, endured not one or two but numerous labors when he at length suffered martyrdom. And then Paul, underneath the picture that I've given, a very beautiful fresco from Mount Athos of the embrace of Peter and Paul, Clement goes on to describe, Paul, preaching both in the East and the West, gained an illustrious reputation, came to the extreme limit of the West. This is the only text we have that is a hint of Paul having preached to the extreme ends of the Roman Empire. People interpret or have interpreted the extreme limit to refer to the so-called Pillars of Hercules, to the area of Gibraltar. And whether or not that's exactly what is meant here is not really our concern. What Clement is doing is taking the example of these two martyrs, reminding people of how much they revere them, how much they respected them, and then reminding them that these men were among those who were persecuted and put to death because of envy and jealousy. And so then as we drop down, and please, you know, go quite a ways down through chapters 6 and 7 and 8, we find that really what he's trying to do is to emphasize that those in Corinth are themselves not unlike the persecutors. They have themselves engaged in a project of envy and jealousy, and they should be ashamed to find themselves in the situation of those who effectively persecute the servants of God. Now, there are quite a number of other valuable themes that occur in this letter that are of importance for the developing tradition of spiritual guidance and spiritual direction. If we drop down to chapter 36, and there's a picture from an antiphoner in the Middle Ages of Christ surrounded by the angelic hosts, Clement provides a kind of a notion of a contemplative vision of the Lord. In chapter 36, it is through Christ that we look up to the heights of heaven. Christ is the one by whom we behold everything in creation, through whom the darkness of our own hearts are opened. And as we'll see, he will go on then to remind people that it is Christ himself. And drop down now to chapter 40. There's a big kind of blue bar and a picture of a bishop with John the Baptist. Now Clement wants to make his point that it is Christ whom we behold, to whom we are drawn in this experience, a vision, who has himself decided to create the ecclesiastical ranks, the ranks of the clergy within the church. This is Christ's own will. And they are modeled, he says in chapter 40, if you look down to the indented section, they are modeled on the Old Testament hierarchies of a high priest, then priests, then Levites. And by the way, the term that is used here for priest, hieros, is very different from the term presbyteros. So it's very important that one watch carefully and not translate the word presbyter or elder as priest, hieros. They are different words that are used specifically in these documents. And although much later, in the 4th through the 6th centuries, the term presbyter will become identical with and will be translatable as priest, that is not the case in this early Christian literature. Because generally speaking, it is the bishop and the bishop alone who was accorded the title of priest, the one who presides at the altar, who celebrates the Eucharist and is the focus of unity. But that's just another point, a kind of a side point in regard to the text here and the others that we'll be looking at a bit later. If we drop down below chapter 41 to chapter 42, another kind of dark red bar and another picture of the apostles, Clement now goes on to describe, having presented the model of Old Testament hierarchies, now he describes what exists within the local church. The apostles have preached the gospel from Christ, from Jesus. Jesus did that coming from God. Christ was sent from God, and the apostles were sent from Christ. And therefore, now Christ has in turn, and the apostles ensured that the apostles would themselves create the offices of bishop, episkopos, and deacon, diakonos. And these are the two principal ministries that exist in the church of Rome in Clement's day. A separate rank of presbyters was either not well defined or did not exist in his church. And again, when the term presbyter is used, he means it to apply to the bishop. That is to say, he's allowing the bishop to be regarded as the elder. The bishops and the deacons are now the new ranks. These are the successors of Christ's apostles. And if you want to look in a little more detail, in that blue bar, there's a description of the fact that when he tries to quote Isaiah as providing a basis for these terms, bishop and deacon, in fact, it's a misquotation of the Septuagint, but a very classical and traditional misquote, which is repeated many times in the later tradition. Now, he really gets down to his point in chapter 43. And below that, he reasserts the doctrine of apostolic succession. What he tries to say in chapter 43 is that the priesthood, the ranks of ecclesiastical service within the church, are reminders of the Old Testament models, which he's already described. And remember, he says, there was strife in the Old Testament in regard to the priesthood. So he's warming up to this idea that the Corinthians are like those who were involved in jealousy and destructiveness in the Old Testament. They have taken on themselves a very bad role. Because, he says, in chapter 44, clearly there is this, what is undeniably, doctrine of apostolic succession. In chapter 44, he says, our apostles knew that there would be strife on account of the office of the episcopate. Therefore, as insofar as they had a perfect foreknowledge of this, the apostles appointed those ministers already mentioned, i.e., bishops and deacons, and afterwards gave instruction that when they should fall asleep, that is, they should die, other approved men should succeed them. So Clement is reminding the Corinthians that their leaders, their bishop in particular, is even though that individual may not have been designated by an apostle, has been designated by those who stand in the succession from the apostles and cannot simply be rejected by the church. That those appointed, or afterwards other eminent men, who are appointed with the consent of the whole church, tes ecclesias passes. And he's implying here that it isn't just the local church that has the right to decide, although certainly if one looks at the liturgies of this period, the consent of the people of God is a very important part of the ritual and practice of how bishops are appointed. Nonetheless, once they are installed, once they are part of the clergy, they are connected with and there with the consent not only of the local but of the whole church, ecclesias passes. So that gives them an authority which the local community does not have the right to undermine without a broader participation in the life of the church. And here we have a very interesting point towards the end of chapter 44, and it's highlighted in yellow with brown letters. These from the episcopate, that is to say, these bishops, who have blamelessly and in a holy way offered the gifts, pros enecantes ta dora. This is undoubtedly a reference to the Eucharist. The Eucharist is the offering of the gifts, which is the particular responsibility of the bishop, and they are not to be ejected. It would be great sin, he says, if you eject from the episcopate those who have blamelessly and in a holy way offered these gifts. So for Clement, the questions, the issues that are arising in the church in Corinth, for which he is attempting to supply answers, and he is himself becoming a spiritual guide, if you will, a kind of a spiritual director. He is reminding these individuals of their connection to the broader church. The example of the martyrs is used as a way of rekindling, reminding them of their own need for a certain kind of docility to not become persecutors. And so he's using that example, that very powerful mindset, as a way of providing a spiritual guidance that causes them to look to their local community as an example of virtue and harmony, but also to look at the broader church. They're not isolated. They're not alone. They're part of a broader community of faith. And just parenthetically, toward the end, the second from the last paragraph, the indented portion in chapter 44, blessed are those presbyters. This is undoubtedly a parallelism. He's intending to say that the episcopoi are also presbyteroi, at least in his understanding, at this partial development of the doctrine of the theology of orders that was present in the last decade of the first century. So we have a hint of spiritual guidance presented by a bishop involving a connection to the Eucharistic celebration, a sense of the significance of the sacraments. This will be highlighted much more powerfully in the letters of Ignatius and then subsequent authors whom we'll be looking at. So just briefly now, looking at chapter 45, he wants to remind them that their zeal should not be for things that don't pertain to salvation. Zealous, that is to say, eager they should be, but not jealous of one another, not in a way that destroys the unity of the local church. And the last little section that I've included here, chapter 49, love unites us to God. There is a bringing into the Lord, which is exercised by the practice of charity, and love, he says, does all things in harmony, en homonoia. So Clement is focusing on the idea of the need for harmony, the need for looking to the local church for examples of and an opportunity for the practice of the virtue that represents the recipient, having experience of having received spiritual guidance and direction from those entrusted with this ministry, which in Clement's model are those who were in charge of the local churches.